Hi, and welcome back to the It's On Us Clemson University podcast. My name is Abigail Anthes, and I'm the current vice president.
And my name is Ava Barros, and I'm the current education coordinator. In this episode, you are going to be hearing from Dr. Crystal Cordes, who's the outreach and consultation coordinator at Clemson CAPS and a part of the CU Cares team working with survivors of trauma, and Lauren Parker and Batsy Smart, who are the Interpersonal Violence Response Coordinators who provide services to survivors on Clemson's campus as well.
This episode is a conversation about the film Promising Young Woman that was put on by Tiger Live in partnership with the IVP office on Clemson's campus and It's On Us. It is intended to be a dialogue about the film and the ways it addresses some important ideas about sexual violence and secondary survivors, as well as some of the ways in which it fell short.
We do want to include a trigger warning, as this episode will be discussing themes of sexual assault and suicide.
We hope this sparks an important conversation and is a reminder that you are not alone.
Feel free to share this episode and don't forget to follow us on Instagram at It's On Us CU.
Okay, hello and welcome to the podcast. My name is Abigail Anthes and I'm the vice president of It's On Us. Thank you all so much for being here. If you want to start, Crystal, and by introducing yourself, that'd be great.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Dr. Crystal Cordes. I am the outreach and consultation coordinator at Clemson CAPS, and I am also a part of the CU Cares team that works with survivors of trauma.
Awesome. Lauren or Batsy, do you want to go?
Yeah, I can go next. Well, my name is Batsy Smart, and I am one of the interpersonal violence response coordinators here at Clemson. We're housed under the Office of Advocacy and Success, and we provide services to survivors.
Hello, I'm Lauren Parker. I am also one of the Interpersonal Violence Response Coordinators for Clemson University, and I am so happy to be here.
Great. Thank you all so much. So we are going to be talking about the Promising Young Woman film, which we watched in McKissick year, and going over some different topics in the film about interpersonal violence as a whole. So if we want to start first, if y'all have like an overall, how did you feel about the film? I would love to hear from you, because at least last night at our It's On Us meeting, a lot of us were talking about how, and I know that part of it is it's addressing these really important things, but it really was just like heavy and triggering. And then the one redeeming part of the romance kind of was also that. And the ending with the whole suffocation scene and all of that was, I don't know. I just want to hear your thoughts on the film as a whole, whether y'all think things could have been done differently or just your ideas.
I think that the film did a good job at representing a lot of the barriers that survivors face in the victim blaming, you know, that goes on. The reality, and I know, I think we're going to talk about this a little bit later too, but the effect on secondary survivors, not just, you know, the survivor themselves, but the effect of all, you know, the trauma that secondary survivors have and the importance of mental health and resources for them as well. But there were other things in the film that I'm like, oh, I wish that they had, you know, done this or done that. And, you know, some of which, or one of which specifically, is I wish that they had shown nice guy, you know, just once. And it didn't even have to, you know, just because there are, you know, and not just guys, people who do care enough to do the right thing and do follow through with that. So I wish they had done that. I get that the point of the movie was to kind of discredit the label or people that, oh, they represent themselves as the nice guy, but they're really not the nice guy. But I wish that they had shown at least one, and not just with the nice guy, but also maybe one resource that did provide or tried to provide or did their best to provide for the survivor themselves, you know, when they were going through the process. That probably would have added a whole another half hour to the movie that was already long. But so there were some things that I wish that they had done a little differently. But at the end of the day, I think that it was, you know, it's a movie, it's entertainment, it's, you know, but so good things, bad things. Crystal and Batsy, I'd love to hear what you guys thought too, because we've discussed it a little bit before and after the movie.
I mean, I agree a lot with what Lauren is saying. I really think the movie was entertaining. I liked that they depicted some of the emotion that goes along with being a survivor, not feeling heard, not feeling understood, trying to figure out how to advocate for yourself. But it also was just really disheartening in the sense of the message being you really can't get justice in this life for anything. Yeah. And that, you know, makes the spidey senses on the back of my neck tingle a little as a therapist, just because I think being a survivor of sexual assault, rape is so difficult already. And it just would be nice to see something that's entertaining where there's actual justice for an actual person who actually is supported by somebody who makes them feel safe and comfortable. Because yes, we should have movies like this, but I don't think that there's enough balance out there in the portrayals of victims and survivors to kind of stand up to this idea that there are no good guys out there. And I think that we keep seeing this messaging in a way that's a little bit unfortunate. And then I also think I wasn't a huge fan of the ways that she went about trying to seek justice and vengeance and how they kind of played with the line there. Because what happened to her was wrong. But I hate that we live in a world where the best way to advocate for yourself is to drug another woman and make her think she was raped, or get somebody to beat up an attorney, or try to kill the guy who hurt your friend. Like, those things are unfortunate. It's not that I don't understand how we got here, but I wish it wasn't the case.
And I agree with Lauren and Crystal. I do think it would have helped to see something that was a little bit hopeful, because in all our jobs, you know, we're saying like, we're here for the survivor and we're trauma informed and we want to help them get to whatever justice or healing looks like for them. And just to see that none of that was portrayed, it's like we're encouraging people to seek help. But then when you watch a movie like this, where every time she did seek help, no good, absolutely no good came from it, not from the bystanders who are recording it, by the way, not from anybody. It was just heartbreaking. And I agree with Crystal. I think it was a little bit thought-provoking. It kind of messes with your moral compass a little bit, just seeing how, like you were saying, Crystal, how she got to the point that she was at. It's also like, well, you're also committing crimes while trying to fight the crime that was committed. And you know, seeing a lot of privilege in that too, because at every single point she gets away with all these things until the very end. And it's hard. It makes you think a little where you're just like, what do I even believe by the time you're done with the movie? But I thought it was a good movie, and I liked that almost for the first time, at least I haven't really seen any movies where the focus is on the secondary survivor and how that messes somebody who still has to live with the impact of something that happened to the primary survivor, especially when they're no longer in the picture. I think that's something that's not talked about enough. And I really like that that was the angle we took with the plot.
Yeah, for sure. Kind of moving on a little bit into our first point about the survivor experience and how in the film we see Cassie confronting lots of different individuals, from her peers in med school to the perpetrator's defense attorney to the dean, and all these different systems that come to play in her friend's assault. How do these different interactions reflect what survivors go through and what they have to face, such as victim blaming and a lack of resources?
I think, unfortunately, it resembles a lot the experience that a lot of survivors have, where it seems like at every point where someone could have been a resource or someone could have been supportive and helped them, they're almost met with a challenge or some sort of barrier, whether it's people not believing in them, or in a case where the perpetrator is a male making statements like boys will be boys, which one of the people said, and kind of doing things that diminish their experience. And of course, there are cases where survivors have a positive experience after the fact, and there are people who are very supportive and believe them and validate what they've gone through and want to help them. But unfortunately, in this movie, it seemed like the survivor it doesn't seem like there was anyone who was really there for her.
I think it really reflected the experience of not being believed that I've heard so many times before and seen so many times as a counselor or a therapist of somebody who is trying to have somebody help them figure out how to advocate for themselves, but they're met with people who are more concerned about the perpetrator or more concerned about the impact on his life and how it could quote unquote ruin his life if she's lying. And I think that all those things can be really disheartening for victims or survivors because it makes it difficult to feel empowered enough to keep taking steps to advocate for yourself and what you need.
Yeah, for sure. Kind of moving on to the secondary survivors and to the focus of the film being that, I agree. Like, I've never seen any film or really like a lot of writings or people talking about secondary survivors and what that looks like. But from the things that y'all have learned and seen, how would you say or give advice to a secondary survivor, a bystander, a friend, a family member of survivors and the things that they go through, the trauma they go through?
I mean, I would say as a therapist, a lot of the time we're talking about something that really kind of boils down to really complicated grief, a lot of sadness about what happened to somebody, how it changes the way you maybe see them or think about them, knowing that they've been through something really hard, anger that you couldn't be there, you couldn't stop it, that you weren't able to intervene, feelings of frustration. I think those victim blaming feelings are not things that family and friends are immune to. So sometimes family and friends will say, I wish they hadn't been drinking, or I wish they hadn't been out and I knew they were headed down the wrong path, or, you know, all of those things that can be really upsetting for the victim themselves, but are things that family and friends are still trying to navigate. I think one of the most compelling things for me from the film was watching the main character go see the mom of the girl committed suicide or the woman who committed suicide, and the mom pretty much kind of pleading with her to just let it go and move on with her life. And I think I see that too in my work, where you have people who have almost kind of let this define a lot of how they navigate their emotions moving forward. And I don't fault them for that, because when you know somebody has been harmed in that way, if you lose someone as a result of something like this, it can be devastating, but it can also be something that can consume you in a way that isn't always healthy. So trying to find ways to help people recognize and acknowledge and validate their experience, but also normalize that it is in your best interest at some point to start to put the pieces back together and figure out how you want to move forward, even if it's in their honor, because, you know, being angry, being hurt, being frustrated and staying in that place can be toxic. And I think this movie showed A, that it can be toxic, and B, that it's easier said than done to move on from something so devastating. So I don't know if there's one answer, but I do recognize the need for help, the need to talk to someone, the need to go seek therapy, especially if you're starting to have feelings that are this rageful and this violent or are this, you know, intense.
Right.
I was going to say, survivor's guilt is real. And I think sometimes, you know, when we talk about survivor guilt, you think, oh, a family died and one person survived. But in a situation like this where she lost her friend, and even if she didn't lose her friend in situations with a survivor, the primary survivor is still alive. But the friend's like, I feel so bad that that happened to them. And sometimes when things like that happen to people that we care about, we kind of get in this thinking of, well, I wish it would have been me instead of them. But then no one should even wish that upon themselves. And I think the same way that we tell survivors, it is not your fault, that extends to secondary survivors as well. Except you played a major role in it happening, you know, except you facilitated the crime. It is not your fault. And in coming back, you know, to that concept of, well, there's nothing. And there's this thread that I saw on social media. The best way to support someone that you care about is to be kind to yourself and make sure that you're not pouring from an empty cup. Because at that point, you could really be doing more than good. So caring for them, validating them, but also taking the time to take care of yourself.
You know, I guess just emphasizing that with any survivor, but, you know, also secondary survivors, that they kind of run a very similar trash loop, playing the what if game. Well, what if I had done this differently? What if I was there? What if, and kind of trying to get that control back as far as I have control over what could have or did happen, which means I have control over what could potentially happen in the future. And so I think that, like Crystal and Bate mentioned, you know, how important kind of letting go of that loop, because the reality is you can't change what happened. You can only change and control how you respond and move forward. And moving forward and letting go does not mean that you're forgetting or you're being disrespectful to the survivor, or, you know, in terms of a secondary survivor, or even, you know, for a survivor themselves, like, it doesn't mean you're forgetting. It means that you are healing. And that is so important, because when you sit in that space of anger and frustration, as Crystal said, it's toxic for you. It's not helping you, or in the sense of a secondary survivor, you're not helping your friend heal and move forward by sitting in that. And that's why it's so important to get that help to work through and process what that looks like for you, because it's going to be different for every single person. Healing is going to look different, and that process is going to be different.
Right. I think one of the things in the film that was interesting to me was whenever the dad kind of says, hey, we lost your friend, but we also lost you. And the moment where she kind of was coming back and he was acknowledging that. And I hate that that was because she was in a relationship and because of a man bringing that. I understand that that can sometimes be the case and people can help you through that. But I think that can be the same for getting counseling, getting help and things like that. And I wish the film had maybe talked a little bit more about that. And like you said at the beginning, just any resource that was actually helpful. And that's not to say friends can't be there for you, but counseling is so important. And yeah, I think when it comes to secondary survivors, people think they can't get help because it didn't really happen to them. And so their trauma isn't something they can really acknowledge. And that if they are doing that, it's lessening like the survivor's hurt or burden. And that somehow acknowledging that you have experienced vicarious trauma is that you are not being a good friend or good support system, that you're somehow weak or not showing up for that person, which is also just not accurate. But I did appreciate that moment with the dad, as well as I think whenever she was confronting the perpetrator at the very end, and she was talking about the way that she saw the change in her friend from being this top in the med school to not being herself at all, and witnessing that shift in her friend to it no longer being her name, but his that she heard, and that experience seeing her friend be so crippled by the trauma she experienced, I think is also a huge part of it. And caring about that and seeing that too, and being on the lookout for any signs of his name or him, and the way that she metaphorically embodied that, trying to carve her name into him, seeing that in her friend, his name almost becoming her identity, witnessing that as a friend. I think that's a very real thing that a lot of people probably experience as a secondary survivor. And I thought it was an interesting way that they portrayed that in the film. Yeah. Kind of moving on a little bit into talking about one of the main themes of the film being the nice guy, which I think is really pertinent with the not all men response movement to Me Too. And yeah, addressing important topics when it comes to men's role in sexual assault and rape culture. In the film, there are multiple men who defend their actions by claiming they are a nice guy and they're a good guy and they would never really hurt women. But how does this perpetuate harmful stereotypes and behaviors relating to sexual violence and assault and a culture that allows this?
I think if you have to say you're a nice guy, you're probably not. That's just something that I always think in my head. Like, if you're like, I'm such a good person, I'm so kind. If other people can see that and say that, then it's probably not real. But something that I like to clarify is, of course, men can be sexually assaulted by women and vice versa. There's no like gender role. It's just unfortunate that overwhelmingly we see male perpetrators and female survivors. But even thinking about this, it's dangerous because it keeps pushing this narrative that there is a certain way that a perpetrator looks and that there's something to expect, you know, when the traditional, it's dark and you're in an alleyway. And sometimes it's just, we see the nice guy, right, at the beginning, almost like disapproving of what his friends were saying, disapproving of their actions. And I'm thinking, wow, he's really about to step up and take this woman home and make sure that she gets home safely. And he almost kind of reels her in, right, with his niceness. Nonetheless, you know, that idea that a nice guy, a not nice guy, nice woman, a not nice woman, like anybody is capable of hurting you. And especially, I think it's easier probably to be hurt by someone that you feel safe with and have trusted for whatever reason. So that can get a little complicated.
Yeah, and I think for the most part, perpetrators of sexual violence and sexual assault, it's not typically someone going out with the intent to harm someone else. Sometimes it is, and it's that black and white, and that's, we need to acknowledge that. But sometimes it is I'm going to make excuses in my head and make this seem okay, like we saw in the film, of she seems pretty drunk. She's saying, hey, I don't feel good, or she's saying, what's going on, or she's saying, I want to go home, but she's awake and she's okay. And explaining those things away. So it's not that he's in his head saying, I want to hurt this woman or assault this woman or this person, but explaining those things away, telling themselves, making themselves feel better of I did nothing wrong and she's okay or they are okay. And I think that's the majority of what happens, is by creating this culture where women are, or people are objectified and seen as property, or men are entitled to sexual things, that allows men to explain these things away and tell themselves they're not in the wrong. They are the nice guy, even after those things. And you saw that with the friend continually reassuring the perpetrator that he did nothing wrong and he never did anything wrong, and him really believing that because he's a nice guy. And I think, yeah, that's what we see. It's not typically someone whose goal is to assault or hurt someone, but it's them explaining and telling themselves that their violence is not that.
I think the nice guy myth is a myth. I think my husband's annoying, but all of my friends think he's amazing. Not because he says that he is, but because in the way he treats me, in the way he behaves, and the way he acts, when I'm like, oh my gosh, he's getting on my nerves, my friends are like, well, Michael would never do that. And I'm like, all of you need to get back on my side immediately. So I think it's not saying you're nice. I think it's in what you do. And I think it's in what you do consistently. Because I think the issue with anyone, not even just saying men, is that most perpetrators of violence, of sexual violence, are people that you know. And if we're talking about within the Black community, one of the highest rates of death in Black women is domestic violence. And most of the times, those are by your partner. And those statistics are similar for lots of different groups, where the people who harm you, the people who hurt you, are most likely to be people that you know. And I believe that most of those people, there's someone in their life who would say that they're nice. It's just that there are certain situations that bring out certain sides of people, and people give themselves permission to behave in certain ways. Mm. And I think that that definitely doesn't justify it or make it okay. But I think that in college, when you think about the drinking culture, when you think about the rape culture, when you think about how normalized it is to be a guy holding a camera while something is happening to somebody else, when you think about habits that are normalized around men, masculinity, you know, to snitch is soft or unacceptable, not even just in male culture, but in society at large, I think we've created a situation where it is unpopular and difficult to side with a victim, and it is easy and safe to be quiet or let it happen. And I think that those people who are teetering on what do I do in this situation are getting a lot more support for doing the wrong thing than I think they should. And I think sexual violence is a horrible, terrible thing, but as somebody who works with both victims and perpetrators, I think that we also, as a society, are doing a really bad job of teaching men that no means no. I think we're doing a really bad job of not sending that boys will be boys message to college with them. And I think that that makes it really, really difficult if you get a pat on your ass for hitting someone in football practice and you get praised for being aggressive, if then you go to school and somebody tells you no. I think we're sending a lot of mixed messages, even in the things that we say we like in men. We celebrate them being masculine and big and look like they could, you know, knock a tree over. Right. But then, you know, we want you to listen and do all these things, but then you're soft for doing them. So it's just really complicated. I have no answers, but I do think that it's important to recognize that I don't think it's just that men woke up one day and decided to be perpetrators of sexual violence. I think that there's a lot of messaging and a lot of permission that we give them to be aggressive with no pause, with no consequence. And I think sometimes we set everyone up to fail with the way we are socializing men.
Right.
Also, when your social standing is determined by the question, what's your body count? And the higher the number, the better. In a lot of social settings, particularly with males, and that just kind of contributes to everything, you know, Crystal said, we're setting people up to fail, to misunderstand, to not listen, to not set boundaries, to not respect boundaries, you know, where a lot of these situations escalate. You know, and sometimes it's unknowingly. I mean, acknowledging that there are situations where that is the case. They think that it's fine because right. We've normalized it. Drunk hookups, we've normalized that in college. Instead of perpetuating the message of checking in, making sure that people are coherent and understand what's going on and getting that consent, it's, well, everybody, you know, is intoxicated. So there's no, it's fine. In throwing everything out the window. So as far as, you know, what role everybody plays, I think not even being gender specific in preventing sexual violence is just that education piece. And then also holding people accountable when they assault somebody, you know, and but also again, following through with that education piece, because some people may not understand that what they did is assault in certain mm-hmm. situations. So it's not making people understand that having sex with somebody when intoxicated, when you're not aware or even conscious, is just as scary and harmful as somebody who jumps out of a bush with a knife and assaults you in an alleyway. And sometimes even more traumatizing because you know and you trusted that person. And you might see that person on campus. You know, it's not a stranger, it's somebody that you know. Because again, when we talk about perpetrators, 9 times out of 10, they know the survivor already. So putting that into that educational piece as far as recognizing that it's just as traumatizing because someone was violated.
Just for clarity, in no way are any of us saying that because of how men are socialized, no. It's okay.
Yeah.
Absolutely not no. saying that. Consequences are a thing for a reason. I don't think there is any justification or excuse for harming another person, not listening to them if they're not giving consent. I think all of that isn't okay. But I think that in educating people on why what they're doing is wrong, there has to be some acknowledgement of how we got here. And I think that that's important, but I don't think it excuses it in any way, shape, or form.
Right.
Thank you, Crystal. That's important.
Yeah, I think it's similar to the idea of most women and most young girls at some point have a talk with their parents or their family or someone in leadership over them of this is how you need to protect yourself in these situations, when this is what the clothes you need to wear around this person or this family member or in these situations to protect yourself, and how to look for perpetrators. But we're not doing the same with men and how to act and treat and respect other humans. And so again, like you said, Crystal, that's not an excuse for those actions at all, but it does explain how that culture comes to be and how it is so normalized and so prevalent because we're establishing that from such a young age in those gendered roles and expectations. But another really important topic in this film about Cassie and the way that she's able to go about her actions without consequences, like you said, Batse, is definitely a part of her identity and her race. In the words of Tarana Burke, sexual violence doesn't discriminate, but the response to it does. So how does Cassie's identity allow her to act in certain ways? And how do societal myths about race and sexuality play a role in responses to sexual violence?
I think Cassie kind of ran amok in the movie. She was just out here in the street, just doing whatever. And I think that that is problematic. I think that we don't have equitable views about who gets to seek justice and equity. I think that it's, even in her death, it was almost poetic. Like, she got to go be with her dead friend. And you see the children, the two little white children walking hand in hand, like on the beach, back together again. And I think that there's just something problematic about all the ways that she was able to kind of A, put herself in danger without consequence, and B, harm other people without consequence in ways that I can't think of any Black female heroines would have been able to do without them putting them in like shaft leather body suits with machetes, because, you know, you have to have armor to be able to just be out here smashing windows, spitting in coffee cups, trying to get people beat up, drugging white women, kidnapping white children. All of these things are things that, like, you almost have to be otherworldly to do as a Black woman in a film. And I think that there was just a level of freedom that she had to be able to do all of these things without really disguising herself in any sort of way, except for the cute wigs, which were cute, that just really felt like it hit me wrong. I think that they made violence seem cool and fighting sexual violence seem like this almost cute story in a way that just really doesn't recognize how many people of color we lose to sexual violence a year, how many trans people we lose, how many people's lives are shaken trying to get the level of justice that she pursued for 2 hours. And I think that that bothered me. Not to say that I don't understand the sentiment, but I think there was something very white and idealistic about this white heroine just being able to do whatever. I mean, if I drugged a white woman and left her in a hotel room, even if I was like, I'm really sorry, nothing happened to you, at best she's going to sue me. At worst, she might kill me or I'm going to jail. So there were some things about it where I was like, this doesn't feel like the way I navigate my life. If I use a harsh tone, sometimes people think I'm threatening. So it just was very difficult for me to not feel a ways about her being a white woman and the way she was pursuing justice.
And I think a movie that was directed and produced by a Black woman does such a good job portraying intersectionality of how survivors, the experience that they have when they go to seek help and seek responses. In that movie, you see one of the main characters' best friend, who is a man, he's a Black man, and he's gay. The experience that he had was very different from the experience that she had as a woman, but even as a Black woman too. And I think it's just the movie, again, like you said, Crystal, we understand how they got to that point. However, it just wasn't realistic, you know, for all the other people who don't identify as white women or people who would have that privilege. And even like the scene where they're arrested, I just know it would have been so much more violent if it was another population, and a population of color. Like, they would not have just been escorted out of the wedding peacefully. Also, the man who ran away would have been shot dead or tased. Like, this could only happen in a white person's world, you know, and it does, you know, speak to a lot of privilege. And I think even for her friend who passes, seeing how many people she's even comfortable going to, well, I wouldn't use the word comfortable, because there's nothing comfortable about telling someone, I've been assaulted, I was raped, you know, in this party with all these people. But she's able to go to all these different people. Unfortunately, they all failed her. But I can only think of the barriers that a survivor of color would have, just thinking about the fact that little Black girls who are children sometimes are addressed as adults because of the way they look, or things that are beyond their control. And all those things that are biological already, it's like the cards are stacked against them. And there's victim blaming before they even get the chance, you know, to say what happened. And unfortunately, that still happens, but it's just, I think, at a disproportionate extent and level, whether it's Indigenous people, whatever, just the minority groups, the experience would be completely different and we would have been watching a completely different movie.
Yeah, I think it's also interesting that Laverne Cox was the token Black friend in the movie when she's like one of the most prominent trans women in film, in media, who advocates for a lot of those things. And there could have been so much more that they did with this film in addressing conversations about that. But instead, she had a very small role. And I just think, yeah, there's so much more that they could have done.
I will say, though, for the Laverne Cox piece, I welcomed her as the sidekick. I am so happy to see trans women having roles in movies that are not streetwalkers, drug addicts, prostitutes, all kinds of versions of like overly hypersexualized, objectified people.
Yeah.
So if she wants to be a business owner and own a coffee shop and not fire this white lady who's spitting in people's coffee, God bless. I thought that was fine. I was here for it.
Yeah. Another thing that I think is really important to address, and we kind of brushed on it, how do you think those identities could have been different in this film if Cassie or her friend were represented as trans individuals?
I don't think it would have, they would have made a movie. I don't think the movie would exist. I think we got to crawl before we walk and walk before we run. And I don't think that we have seen, outside of shows and movies about trans people, I don't think we have seen feature films with trans people as the lead protagonist yet. So to see them as the lead protagonist fighting crime and fighting for justice feels like something that we are so far from, but I would love to see. But I don't really know how it would have looked. I think, again, when Black people or people of color or marginalized folks fight for justice, it ends up looking like Denzel Washington, Man on Fire. Like, there's no, we don't normalize it. You don't get to have a job. You get to wear all leather like you're in the Matrix and go out there with a machete and a machine gun fighting crime full time. You die epically and tragically at the end and people weep for you, but you save the world. But there's no way for us to be humanized in that. And I think we struggle with humanizing marginalized people who want justice and are still compelling people who deserve to be seen as complex and dynamic characters. I don't think we do a very good job of that. Or we make people almost like mammy characters of like, they're not sexualized at all. They're just sad, strong women who are fighting crime for somebody else, but you don't see like both. You don't get to go out to the nightclub and be pretty and attractive and want all of these things at the same time. I just don't think we do a good job of making duality a thing for some of our marginalized folks.
Kind of adding to what Crystal said, I think there's not a lot of, again, back to the word of privilege, you don't really get the privilege to be multidimensional. And this idea of whether it's people of color or non-binary, you know, you're just resilient. You know, all the things you've been through have made you so resilient. You don't really get to have like a normal Tuesday morning breakdown. It's going to be something very extreme. And like Crystal said, you're not going to spit in someone's coffee and then have them fall in love with you. That's just, you know, it doesn't really work like that. And I just feel like those things are not talked about. And it's like, we want to choose how uncomfortable we can be, because a movie like that would make a lot of people very uncomfortable. And, you know, it's like, we want to be uncomfortable and have these discussions about sexual violence, but like, not quite, you know. Let's reel it in a little bit and still keep it like PG, everyone. But when you just think about the fact, and I just I think in a nutshell, I would just say any groups that don't fall within the majority, the script would be different and would probably not exist because there isn't even enough representation for the daily struggles that transgender people go through. How much more when they've experienced something like that and then there's a system that's failing them as is parallel to their reality. I just feel like that's a little too real and it would not, there wouldn't be a good response.
Kind of along the lines of what you're saying, of you kind of have to pick and choose which areas you want justice for, and that intersectional justice for these things doesn't exist and isn't possible in a lot of spaces. You could speak out against sexual violence, but not if it includes trans people or not if it includes Black people, because that's too much, makes people too uncomfortable. You can only do so much uncomfortability, and sexual violence is enough. How have you experienced being able to push those bounds and spaces like Clemson University or other areas in your career that you advocate for all of those things collectively and not having to separate out different identities?
I mean, I would say working at Clemson, I don't necessarily feel like I've had to turn the volume down on how I think about advocacy and justice and equity. I would say throughout my career, though, I've made peace with the fact that I need a PhD because, man, I have a lot of feelings about a lot of things. So that was essential for me to kind of continue this trajectory. And then, you know, having to be really strategic about making sure I show up in spaces as my whole self makes it a lot easier for me to advocate for people who are marginalized, and being okay with the fact that it's not always going to feel comfortable. Like, I can't have it both ways. I can't be the person who's trying to create space and then want safety and comfort and support and warm feelings from the people who need to create that space for the things that are important to me. So I've had to be very intentional about my own self-care of, like, do you have people in your life who can support you and care for you and love on you on those days when advocating and fighting is hard, or the political climate is difficult, or you're saying something that people don't want to hear today? So I can go get that support somewhere else, and I can go back to work, and I can take a deep breath, and I can keep trying to create space for people like me, for people not like me, for identities that don't have a seat at the table yet, and for people who need more room than maybe I can give them. I have to keep working at it. And I think making peace with not always being comfortable with those conversations being difficult has made it so that I can go there with my cup full. So I'm not looking for you to feel great about having a conversation that's difficult, but I can support you in having that conversation because I'm nourished enough to be able to navigate that in a way that doesn't exhaust me. I think that there's a lot of burnout for people who are trying to make conversations about advocacy intersectional. And I think some of the people who are burnt out the fastest are our marginalized folks who are having every single one of their conversations be hard. And I think it's important to recognize the need and the value for self-care, for taking care of yourself so that you can literally enter the ring and do what you need to do and then go home and like feel loved and understood and feel like you're not crazy for wanting these things. So I think for me, I'm just very intentional about taking care of myself so that when people are like, can Crystal shut up about social justice and equity already? I'm like, I get it, sis, but here we are again today. And it doesn't feel exhausting at this point in my career.
Yeah. Kind of along a similar line when it comes to sexual violence and also really any form of social justice, there's a lot that can take a toll on in terms of mental health, but there's obviously a lot of stigma and discrimination towards survivors and in regards to sexual violence. How can we work to break down these attitudes and also what are resources that you all provide at your offices on campus for survivors struggling with mental health, but also other areas on campus?
I mean, as a therapist, I would say encouraging survivors to go to counseling is important. Don't be afraid to shop around for a counselor that's a good fit for you. I can say honestly, you know, I'm not for everybody, but I think it's important to be selfish and looking for what it is that you need for yourself and your healing, because everybody deserves to feel safe and comfortable in their bodies and in the world. I think continuing the conversations between the people who support survivors and survivors themselves is important. So things like this podcast, things like CAPS and CU Cares working with It's On Us and other organizations to try and work through stigma and discrimination and making sure that we're all unified in our messaging about how essential it is to get help and how normal it is. I will say too, I think something that's going to be important in changing the landscape is I think we have way too much distance between people who work with survivors and people who work with perpetrators. I think as a clinician who's committed to doing trauma work, it's important for me to be able to do both, because I think that we have this expectation that men and people who are most likely statistically to be perpetrators be educated, but then it's almost like everybody puts their hand on their nose and is like, not it. I don't want to do the education. And I think that people who care as much as some of the people I work with care about survivors need to be the people who are helping to inform that education. Because I think right now, primarily the people who are doing the education are men or people who are responsible for remediating men who've harmed people. And I think that that dichotomy is a problem. So I think that finding ways to bring some of those conversations together and make them a little bit more unified and not have a victim conversation and a perpetrator conversation is going to be essential. But, you know, I think that that takes time. And I think that's something that has to happen in a way that makes everybody feel safe. And that's not going to happen overnight. But I do think that those things are important.
I will definitely just stress, I can't tell you how many times I've sat across from somebody and had, and literally word for word said, be selfish, be selfish. It's okay to be selfish, you know, to focus on yourself. You need to focus on yourself right now. Well, I made the commitment to do this, or, you know, work, school, relationship, whatever it is, like, and I feel bad taking a break. I feel bad stepping back from that to focus on myself. And so to say it's okay to be selfish in these situations and to do that, and it's almost necessary, you know, it's that long-term versus short-term. If you're going to heal and move forward, that requires that attention and focus on yourself now. And it is perfectly okay, because at the end of the day, that's just a job, you know, and yes, school is important, but you can always come back to that. And you're going to be coming back to that in a better, hopefully, headspace so that you can be more successful, and how important it is to take that time to do that self-care, to start moving forward and healing so that you can do all the other things you want to be successful in better. Because when you're sitting in that unhealthy, toxic headspace, it's very, very difficult to do that consistently. And with trauma, it's very up and down, as far as, you know, you could have a really good day and then a really bad day. And then you feel bad because you have the bad day, you know, and you're like, well, why am I not doing well? Or I was always doing well before. So understanding too, that trauma affects everybody differently. And it is that holistic approach of mental and emotional health. You know, it affects that area, but it also affects academics, and it also affects your relationship with your significant other or your family, or, you know, it's intersectional. It affects all areas of your life, and not always in a, you know, in a negative or positive way. And understanding that, I think, is very important when moving forward in that process, and that it's not linear, as Batse put it at one point. And I think that's important. And again, having conversations, you know, to kind of normalize mental health and the importance of it, because it does affect all those other areas. You cannot be successful in academics if you are constantly anxious about leaving your house to get to class. You have to address that anxiety first so that you can go to class, so that you can learn.
Yeah. And I think like what both Crystal, you and Lauren are saying about like the phrase selfish, the idea that that's even a negative thing is also a part of the conversation, that getting help for yourself is seen as this horrible, selfish, bad. Being selfless and idealizing that to be the top number one thing that anyone can be is just harmful in and of itself. Taking care of yourself is not a negative or harmful thing. That is one of the most important things you can do in order to be there for yourself and also to be there for anyone else and to show up for anyone else. So I think if the idea of being selfless is that you can help other people, the best way to do that is to help yourself first. And that is not a negative thing. And being selfish is not a negative thing. Loving yourself first, especially for all people, but especially as women, that is like one of the worst insults you can tell someone is that they love themselves or that they're full of themselves. But I think that that's just foolish. Like loving yourselves, taking care of yourself, being selfish is one of the best things you can do for yourself and for everyone else. So yeah, I love that y'all are advocates for that and that your offices are places that are safe and can be spaces for all people on this campus and all people in this area to learn how to do that better. Because I think no matter if you've been going to therapy for your whole life or you've never been before, you still have to learn how to do that well and how to love yourself well and be selfish in those ways. So I'm really thankful that you all are spaces that are helping people learn that and creating space for that. I think for me, one thing that I would love to hear from y'all is afterwards, at least for me personally, after watching the film, I didn't really know what to do with myself. I felt unsafe going back to my dorm on campus. I didn't know if I should watch something else to kind of tune it out or have a conversation about it with a friend. So in general about this film or really anything that could be triggering to someone, what would your advice be for them to be able to do that on their own if they can't reach someone like y'all right away? What would your advice be for them?
First and foremost, I guess acknowledging that that's normal to watch something heavy and then to have an emotional reaction and then also not know what to do with it, you know, not immediately. So at least for me as a non-counselor, I would reiterate that knowing yourself and being self-aware on what helps you cope with things in a healthy way, whether that is talking it out to process what your feelings are with a friend or whomever that you trust, to listen and acknowledge and validate how you feel. And also maybe it is going back to your dorm or your apartment and watching a feel good movie, something like, I don't know about you, but I have a set of movies that when I'm down or not feeling good and need me like a pick me up, like I have three that I will go and watch and it does make me feel better, or it makes me cry a lot, which then makes me feel better, you know? So having that emotional outlet, even if you don't really know what that emotion is that you're kind of in, I think is very helpful. So that having a conversation and that self-care piece and being aware of what works best for you is very important, I think.
I think knowing what, like Lauren was saying, like what soothes you and what helps you function or feel better is important preventatively. Like I tell people all the time, if you're having a panic attack, doing meditation for the first time isn't going to work. If you've never used mindfulness, trying to be mindful when you cannot breathe is not it. It's not going to make you feel better. So if that's not something that you already have in your muscle memory, you're not going to be able to use it at a time where you're having a hard time coping and functioning. So thinking about what those things are and being self-aware is important. I also think figuring out how to regulate your emotions is also just really important. So starting with the basics of identifying what you're feeling, because we say triggered, but what does that mean? Do you feel anxious? Do you feel scared? Do you just feel uncomfortable? Are you angry? So figuring out first, what emotion are you actually experiencing is important. And then deciding what caused that emotion. So this is something I say to my clients all the time. What are you feeling? What caused it? So was it the movie? Were you mad that people in the movie were laughing? Were you mad that the person in the movie was white and got away with all this stuff? Were you triggered by specific scenes, or is there something in particular that made you feel what you feel? And then being intentional after you've identified your emotion and identified what caused it about what do you want to do about it? So sometimes I think we skip the first two and we go straight to the third thing. And we're like, I don't know. I'm like, well, because you don't know what you're feeling and you don't know why. So let's identify those things first and then decide intentionally, what do you want to do about it? Because I think that sometimes we don't sit with ourselves and give ourselves the space to make choices. Mm-hmm. We feel like things are happening to us, and that's very overwhelming. So just decide what you want to do and then execute, whether that's with a friend, whether that's alone, and just see how that feels for you. And when you start to feel yourself feeling emotions again, do the exact same exercise. And eventually the feeling will pass. And if it doesn't, call CAPS.
Yeah. Thank you. That was awesome from both of y'all. Well, if y'all want to share any final thoughts about the film or just the conversations we've had, thank you all for being here so much. I know we're a little over time, but I'm really thankful for y'all and all your knowledge and wisdom.
I would just say, though, that I do think that the film starts conversations. It does make you think about real issues that are going on, and presenting the opportunity like this one to have conversations around those themes. And I think that that's very important. So thank you for doing the podcast.
Yeah, I'm glad that this came out of that for sure.
And I was just going to add, I think something that's important after watching something like this is just to unpack it. I think trying to have all those thoughts in your head, it can be a lot and it can be like a pressure point. And so talk to someone about it and be very honest about what you're feeling. Like, there's no need to sugarcoat anything and be like, I just feel so inspired, you know? But I think it's important to unpack it. And yeah, thank you for creating the space for not just students, but for us to also have conversations like this.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you all so much.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode and joining in with us on the conversation. If you would like to learn more about resources, want to get involved in It's On Us, or have any questions, feel free to reach out to us and follow us on Instagram at itsonuscu. If you have any topics or questions you would like to be discussed in future episodes, you can submit them to our Instagram. Also, make sure to check out the new Interpersonal Violence Response Coordinator's website, as well as the list that can be found on our Instagram's link tree of all the upcoming events for Sexual Assault Awareness Month this April. Thanks again for listening, and remember that you are not alone and you are believed.